On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
We're delighted to welcome back to On the Bookshelf, Steve Barry, the New York Times number one internationally best-selling author of 17 Cotton Malone novels, 5 standalone thrillers, and several works of short fiction. He has 25 million books in print, translated into more than 40 languages. And he, with his wife, are the founders of History Matters, an organization dedicated to historical preservation. He serves as an emeritus member of the Smithsonian Libraries Advisory Board and was a founding member of International Thriller Writers, formerly serving as its co-president. His website is Steve Barry, that's like a strawberry, BERRY.org. You can also find him on Facebook. His newest book is The Last Kingdom. Story of the Last Kingdom is yet another fascinating Cotton Malone adventure, and we're delighted to welcome Steve Barry back to On the Bookshelf.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
This novel is primarily based in and around Bavaria. I would imagine that most Americans are not really too conversant with Bavaria as a political entity. Mostly they think about Bavaria as part of a description of something, Bavarian ale or Bavarian clothing or something like that. But the region of Bavaria, according to your research and the time that you have spent there, and it's an extraordinarily vital and fascinating part of European history, correct?
Absolutely. It's now part of Germany, one of the German states. Germany is broken up into states similar to where America's broken up into states. But the Bavarian state has always had a streak of independence to it. It came into the alliance late. It was an independent duchy, or basically a nation of its own, ruled by the Wittelsbach family for 800 years. And shortly before World War I, when Germany began to unite, it was swept up and brought into the new unified Germany. The secession movement has been something that's been there for a long, long time, and I just play off that in the novel and give it a little more oomph than it does have in real life. But in reality, there is a strong independence movement there. They never really ratified the German Constitution, and they never really signed on to Germany. They just kind of got swept up in it, and so I used that as part of the novel.
Cotton Malone is a very familiar character for people who love your novels. You want to tell us a little bit about his background? So I was late getting to your series, but since I've been able to pick up the series, I've been able to find previous editions or previous books online and so forth, and so I've been able to read a lot of the adventures. But the thing that I like very much about the series is not only the historical research that you put into each one, but also the fact that each novel could be a standalone novel. If you didn't read the previous ones, that you miss some of the connectivity that is referenced in the newest one, but you could still enjoy the novel even if you knew nothing about the character except walking in. This is not just a happy accident.
I write the books where you do not have to read them in order, and you don't miss anything if you don't. If you read them in order, you will recognize some things along the way, but if you don't read them in order, those things will not jump out and annoy you. So I'm very conscious of the fact that you can pick up the series at any point. So if you've never read a Cotton Malone book before, there's 17 of them. You can start with The Last Kingdom. I've had people even read the series backwards. And so you can do it however you want to do it. I write them that way to be flexible.
What's the most fun thing about Cotton Malone for you, this very interesting character that you've created?
Well, he's capable of doing extraordinary things when it's called upon, and so he can step up and do some things quite extraordinary. He's not I say all the time, he's not a Daniel Craig kind of guy. He's not, he doesn't buff up at the gym and he doesn't do all of that. He's more a George Clooney kind of guy, but he can step up and do extraordinary things if called upon. And that's a lot of fun to have a guy that can step up and do those kinds of things.
He certainly gets an opportunity to do that in this particular novel. He retired from the intelligence game per se. It's been a couple of years since he stepped away from it, but he gets called back into it from time to time, just like in the last novel. There are some references to that in The Last Kingdom. I think The Warsaw Protocol was the first of your books that I read. It really made a huge impression on me because I had recently been in Poland and I knew whereof you spoke. The Last Kingdom makes some references to that, but like you said, you don't have to have read previous novels to still enjoy it.
No, there's a couple of little references to what happened in those novels in the course of the story, but if you had not read those, you really wouldn't even know what that was. It wouldn't bother you that I made it. But if you've read those, you recognized immediately what I was talking about.
Cotton Malone is what we might call a non-traditional intelligence agent. This is not a James Bond kind of character, but he certainly is capable, and he certainly is smart, and he certainly can react, and is well trained. He previously worked for an organization which we're going to assume is an invented organization, is yet another sort of black ops type.
It's part of the Justice Department. It's called the Magellan Billet, and I did make it up. I made it up. It's not real, but you know, Cotton got signed on to that very early on. The novel The Bishop's Pawn is an origin story for Cotton, so if you want to know how that happened, you can, readers could check out that book. But he worked for that for a number of years, and then he retired out. Now, the one thing about what I was saying in Cotton's world now is time has stopped in his world. Time does not really go like it does in our world. He's been 47 for the last like 10 books now, and he'll always kind of stay that way. I haven't aged him at all, so time is a very slow concept in the Cotton Malone world. I learned that from Clive Cussler. You know, he wrote Dirk Pitt for 50 years, and
right,
he never aged.
Yeah.
So I learned not to do that.
He's a busy fellow, but then again, if you're this kind of guy, these things can all happen in pretty quick order, too. It's not like he's spending months and months and months working on a case, right?
Traditionally, my books go between 1 and 3 days is my books, about 24 to 72 hours. The only one that broke that rule is the Charlemagne Pursuit, which went over about a 10, 12-day period. But there was a lot of international travel in that book that required that extra time. But normally, I do the books, you know, within a 1 to 3 day span, yes.
Which actually does make it possible for him to be 47 for quite some time.
Yeah, that's true.
He has time to recuperate in between missions, or between opportunities anyway. Now, Cotton Malone is running a bookstore in Denmark, not as a cover, but that's what he likes to do when he stepped out of the intelligence game full time. But he does get called upon not by King and Crown, but by the president and by his former boss to step up when it's needed. And in this particular case, he's dealing with some people who knew him or knew of him when he had missions that coincided with the CIA or he was actually a part of the CIA.
Yeah, well, his protege, Luke Daniels, is a younger version of Cotton who does work for the Magellan Billet, has called upon Cotton to come help him out. He just needs a little, you know, a little help, a little assistance, and then that assistance turns into something far more complicated. And, you know, Cotton's a little fond of Luke, even though they have a kind of a rocky relationship, and he's a younger version of Cotton. So Luke can make mistakes. Luke can screw up. Luke can be a little more impetuous than Cotton would be. And Cotton gets drugged into this mission that Luke is on, and he has to see it through, and that's the way he is. He'll help a friend out, and that's what he's doing.
Do we want to talk a little bit more about the Wittelsbach? I found this very interesting, that this is one of the things that you research that is factual, that there really has been this family that has really been ruling this region for hundreds of years, and that ceased after. To a certain extent, see after the Franco-Prussian War, or?
Well, the Wittelsbachs ruled Bavaria for 800 years, and then towards the end of the middle of the 19th century, Ludwig II became king. And Ludwig II is the focus of this novel. He's one of my favorite historical characters. The actual Wittelsbach dynasty ended in 1917 during World War I, when the last Wittelsbach basically abdicated and walked away from it. But the Wittelsbachs still exist to this day, and there's some, you know, that say that they want their kingdom back. Some Bavarians would like to have their king back, and I play on that in the novel. I just expand on that in the novel, because Ludwig II was a very interesting guy. Many people call him Mad King Ludwig, and that's not a good description. I don't like to call him mad. He was probably manic, depressant, maybe bipolar. Today we would treat him with medication, and he should be fine, but not back then. He had a lot of issues with him. He also had an obsession of a magical thought of what a king should be. He didn't think kings should be constrained by government. They should be able to do whatever they want, build whatever they want, create whatever they want. So he actually did send a man around the world to look for him a new kingdom he could rule over. This is historical fact. And I use that in the novel as well. In my case, in reality, he did not find that. In the novel, he does. And now Germany, China, and the United States are all after that kingdom, but for totally different reasons. And that's where the race is on.
Now, I know we don't want to give too many hints away or too many secrets away, but there is a king of a kingdom that existed that was a small kingdom during the latter part of the 19th century who also traveled around the world.
That is a historical fact. He actually did. He was the first monarch, by the way, to ever do that. And this king, and we could probably say a little bit about that because that's pretty much revealed very early in the novel. Let's just say that there's a connection between Germany and Hawaii, and it's real, and it exists, and it forms the basis of this novel.
All right, since we can talk a little bit about that, this is one of those not as pleasant parts of American history that involves Hawaii. Hawaii was an independent kingdom that did business with other nations and ended up becoming a territory of the United States, not because the people of Hawaii rose up and said, we want to be part of the United States, but because the planters and the industrialists who were starting to find more and more about Hawaii that they liked thought it ought to be a part of the United States. And essentially, and correct me if I'm wrong, more or less had a coup d'etat.
Pretty much, yeah. They just overthrew the monarchy. They certainly did. This was in 1898. They had a revolution, basically. It didn't last but a few hours, and they overthrew and took control and eventually got Hawaii annexed in as part of the United States, and then, of course, it became a state in 1959. But, we basically just stole it. That's what we did.
Yeah. And now, later on, I did not know this, and I'm assuming it's true, because when you have these kind of facts in a story, they're verifiable, that there was a president who basically apologized to Hawaii for what we did to them and was hoping that the Congress would take the hint and maybe either restore their sovereignty or work out some better deal than Hawaii got. But the Congress did not rise to the motion.
No, not at all. Grover Cleveland basically wanted to give it back and to fix it, but the Congress did not do it. This was a time of manifest destiny in this country when we felt like we were entitled to take whatever we wanted to, and they basically just took Hawaii, and it became a territory of the United States for about 60 something years until it finally became a state. But there's an interesting connection between Hawaii and Germany that I found fascinating, and it forms the basis of this novel.
That's probably as much as we can say without giving too much away, correct?
Correct.
Yeah,
we've got to be careful.
Yeah, be
a little careful there.
The time, but we can say this, that when Hawaii became a territory of the United States was about the same time that we got involved in a 30-year war for independence in Cuba. As a matter of fact, as we speak, this is within a few days that when we're doing the interview of the anniversary of the explosion of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor, which was the event that pretty much precipitated us declaring war on Spain, and within 3 months defeating their forces. The Cubans had won their freedom after 30 years of fighting against the Spanish, and with a lot of complicated stuff, which might make an interesting novel for you, that might be a tie-in for another novel about filibustering and all of that that took place for several years prior to 1898. This was just a time when we thought, well, these territories are close. We kind of need them. We need coaling stations for this new modern Navy that we're building. The Hawaiian Islands were almost exactly in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and we needed them, and about the same time that we got them, we ended up with the Philippines for 40 years or so as a result of the Spanish-American War. So that was our little brief foray into imperialism.
Pretty much, yeah. We got a little crazy then, and we went a little too much going on then, and we sort of branched out around the world. We eventually lost just about all those territories and all those things, but we did keep Hawaii though.
And of course, because of that, the history of the world was directly affected. When you do research for a novel, Steve, do you do most of it by going to libraries? Or now in Bavaria, you have kind of an interesting connection to Germany, right?
Interesting that I go there all the time, and I've been there quite a bit. I love the country. I particularly love Bavaria. It's one of my favorite places in the world.
So there are a lot of things that you reference in the book that you know are real things, like this majestic body of water, also known as the German Sea, is that
the Chiemsee. The Chiemsee is the largest lake in Germany. It's a beautiful lake, and there's an island in the middle of the lake where Ludwig II built Harem Chiemsee, which is his castle that he built there, which is like a replica of Versailles, and it's quite magnificent. He never finished it, but there's parts of it were finished, just small parts, and the novel opens there in Harem Chiemsee. We visit really all three of Ludwig's castles. We do Harem Chiemsee, Linderhof, and then Neuschwanstein. Neuschwanstein would be very recognizable to people because Walt Disney visited there in the 1930s, and that's what he used as the model for Sleeping Beauty's castle.
Right.
So it's very, very familiar to people. And yes, all three of these castles figure into this novel. This is, as I said, one of my favorite places in the world. I've been wanting to put this into a novel for a long, long time, and finally got the chance here.
Now, is the idea of having three castles in a kingdom like Bavaria, is that out of the ordinary, or is that more likely to be? I mean, when we think of castles in the United States, we tend to think of a king had a castle, and they reigned from that castle, and they passed it down to their sons, and they passed it down to their sons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's really not exactly what happens, right?
No, Ludwig was a grand builder. He had a great imagination. He loved to build, and he loved to create. And these are fantastical places. All of these castles are incredible. They're all different, very different, and very interesting, but very, very imaginative. They remain today the largest tourist attractions in all of Germany. So his legacy, he bequeathed them something that has made that country an awful lot of money over the decades. He was going to build a fourth one, but never got a chance to. He was deposed and removed from power in 1886 and mysteriously died 3 days later. So, you know, to this day, we do not know how Ludwig died or what happened with it, and all of that is in the novel as well. All of that figures out, you know. So people who've never read me before, my books deal with something from the past, something real, but something that still matters today. So it's a modern-day thriller dealing with something from the past.
We're talking, in case you're joining us late, to Steve Barry, who's the author of The Last Kingdom, his newest novel in the Cotton Malone series. It's from Grand Central, which is an imprint of the Hatchett Book Group. Is this Cotton Malone novel number 17, correct?
Correct. Okay. 17th Cotton Malone book.
We have just a few minutes left to talk, but I did want to ask you about some of the other things that you reference in here, some cultural things that you talk about, the fellas in the black robes that are sort of ceremonial, do ceremonial things. Is this an actual thing, or is this just some?
No, it's real. It's real. It's called the Gaggle Miner, and they are a group that's been around since the Middle Ages. They originally were designed to escort bodies and coffins to their graves as a form of respect, and they wore black robes. They looked very much like Ku Klux Klan, but with black robes on. And that was their original function, but then during the time of Ludwig II, they got kind of attached to Ludwig, particularly with his sudden death. And they've existed in the last 100 years or so as basically an organization bent on proving that Ludwig was murdered. They would like also Bavaria to be separate from Germany. They're like a separatist organization. And they actually do exist. They perform a lot of stunts. Publicity stunts designed to draw attention to their causes, and I came across them, so I factored them into the story, so they're a part of it as well.
Can we mention that there was a cipher wheel, an antique cipher wheel that that shows up. Okay. So this is going to be, I think, also interesting that here in Bavaria, there at some point is the discovery of a Confederate cipher wheel. Tell us about that.
Well, they were real. They were used as a decoding and coding device by the Confederate States during the Civil War. It is a well-known historical fact that the Confederacy sent representatives all over Europe trying to get monarchs and kings and queens and emperors to support their cause monetarily and militarily. Some did go to Germany. Some did visit with Ludwig. Ludwig was fascinated by those kinds of things. So I wondered what would happen if they had actually gave him one of those. So they actually did. They gave him one. And so it figures into the story. In all of my books, I try to keep my books about 90% to reality. I keep them as close to reality as I can. So here, the reality is all of that I just told you. The 10% I trip up is they gave him the cipher wheel. I don't know if they gave him one or not, but in my story they did, and it figures into the story. And these cipher wheels are quite remarkable. There are only a handful of originals still left in the world, and I've seen replicas of them. In fact, I have a replica of one, but the originals are very hard to come by, and it's a very good way to decode something, by the way, too. It's very tough to break the code from the cipher wheel, and I thought that'd be cool to work it in here, so it figures into the story, too.
I thought so, too. I'd heard about them in other books and felt like they were probably true, but having it showing up in this one was just another delightful little nugget there. Also, Ludwig II was really a huge fan of Richard Wagner.
Very much so. He was very much a Wagner. He loved Wagner. He loved Wagner's operas. He loved Wagner's imagination. He loved Wagner's stories. Schweinstein is loaded with paintings and tapestries and everything all over the walls from Wagner's operas. And they do figure a little bit into this novel as well. He was pretty much obsessed with Wagner. He became his major patron until Wagner died during Ludwig's reign. Some say it might have been a little bit of an unhealthy obsession on Ludwig's part, but it was an obsession nonetheless.
And the death of Ludwig II is still considered mysterious, not completely understood, right?
Nobody knows. Him and his psychiatrist went for a walk on a rainy Sunday evening, and they never came back. Their bodies were found in the lake, drowned. To this day, we have no idea what happened, how it happened. Nothing. We really don't. His grave has never been opened. His grave has never been violated, and so we have no idea what really happened that night. It remains a mystery.
Fascinating. I really enjoy reading your books because I always learn something about the history and culture of different countries by reading them, that's an added joy. Plus, you spin a great yarn, and I can see why you're a best-selling author because your stories are really wonderful. I know that every author, when they are in the process of promoting a book that's finished and published and available for sale, that you're already working on another one too, so I hopefully we'll be hearing from Cotton after people enjoy The Last Kingdom and get their appetite whetted for another novel, that there'll be another Cotton Malone book coming along next year or so.
There will be. It's called The Atlas Maneuver, and it will be out next spring. Cotton will be back in a new adventure, but then this summer I have a new kind of book coming out. Luke Daniels, the young guy from the Cotton Malone series, is going to have his own series. He's going to have three books of his own. I'm writing those with the great thriller writer Grant Blackwood. The first one will come June 27th. It's called The Ninth Man, and it deals with something from the JFK assassination, something I think that will shock a lot of people. I know it did me, something that kind of gets you to go like, whoa, I didn't know that. So Luke will have his first adventures. So for the next 3 years, there are going to be two Steve Berry books a year.
Nice. Well, I look forward to talking to you again, not just this time next year, but halfway through this year. It sounds like a great opportunity.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Steve, anything else that you wish that I'd ask you about your new book, The Last Kingdom, that I did not?
No, I I would just say if anybody wants to check out me or my books, they go to steveberry.org. Everything is there.
Excellent. Excellent.
And The Last Kingdom is out now. It's in stores everywhere.
Wonderful. Steve, thank you very much. I enjoyed your book a whole lot, and I look forward to the next one that's coming up with the protege getting his spinoff into his own book. I'm looking forward to reading about Luke.
June 27th, it'll be here.
Excellent. Thanks so much, my friend.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Our thanks again to Steve Berry, the author of The Last Kingdom, his newest novel in the Cotton Malone series from Grand Central Publishing, which is an imprint of the Hatchett Book Group. And once again, it's available online and in bookstores everywhere. So by all means, go into a bookstore and check it out for yourself and see if they have some other Cotton Malone books still around. You'll enjoy them, I guarantee it. His website again, steveberry.org. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening to On the Bookshelf on WTBF Radio and my podcast, onthebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next time, thanks for listening and God bless. Every Sunday at 9:30 on FM 94.7 and at 11:30 on AM 970 and FM 96.3, hear some of the best authors in America today discussing their new books. On the Bookshelf, an exclusive presentation of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTBF.